Okay, let's get started. The as we go through the Department of Health today, they've got a they have developed a presentation on the Medicaid option, the waiver, the merits of doing that. So Director Forslund will provide that to us. It's a pretty good presentation. And then we've got we want to talk a little bit about health exchanges, and we promised him that as long as he knows more than us, we're in good shape. And then we need to talk about just the format of the budget, because remember, with the budget, the way it came out last year, instead of requiring the 4%, we actually did a hard number for them. And the hard number gets then embedded in. We did a 4% cut, a hard cut, so the number was put in. And we're marching towards the next biennium. And how that gets presented in the budget bill is a little different because of that. And for the members that are still standing in January, they how you do the Gov's recs will be dependent on kind of how we're working through the day. I think that you may not be working off the budget bill for the Gov's rec, rather have a summary sheet or new sheet. So let's begin with Director Forslund. I'm going to have you start your presentation at 8:30 because three of us have to leave. And I've heard your presentation, so I want to make sure I hear everything else. So at 8:30, we'll have you do the Medicaid option, and then we'll be back at 9, the three of us. And so to begin with, Brett, do you want to take us through the budget now and explain what's happened, what we're seeing, and then we talk a little bit about how we're going to do markup.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could get everyone to turn to page 4 of the agency's budget, which is, for those of you using an iPad, it's page 405 in volume 2. And this is the what we call the B sheet. It's the summary sheet for the agency. And this is structured a little bit differently than the other budgets that you have seen to this point in time or any others that you will see following review of the Department of Health. And the first thing I would point out to you is that the headings are different from...
We've had enough of you, Brett.
Apparently. So if you go to page 4 again and we start with the headings, you'll note that the headings on the first two columns are different from those that what you've seen before. Column 2 is headed with the 2014 appropriation budget bill. And specifically, this is not the full appropriation for the agency for the 13-14 biennium. You may recall that there are two separate appropriations for the Department of Health in the appropriations bill. It's the only agency that has two separate appropriations. This is reflective of 48B as it appears in the appropriations bill. And so it represents approximately half of the agency's appropriation for 13 and 14. This is... the most notable difference between the 14 appropriation and that in 13 is that it's approximately $19 million plus less than the appropriation in 13, which is known as 48A. And so at the request of LSO staff, they wanted this to mirror the 14 appropriation, and so that's how we've structured this. And then in column 3, you'll notice instead of an 8% reduction, it's entitled funding reallocation. And if you look at that top section on page 4, effectively what you're looking at are a set of net to zeros. And this reflects reallocation of that reduced funding that has been proposed by the agency in the 2014 appropriation. So in other words, they are proposing to move funding between divisions, between the appropriation level that appears in your bill, to reflect where they think that reduced funding most appropriately would reside. In the course of discussions during the 2012 budget session, the reductions due to the timing of when this occurred were applied in a fairly arbitrary manner. It was our understanding, and I believe the agency's understanding, when we left those discussions, that they would have the ability to determine how to reallocate those and ultimately present those to this committee for review. This creates some difficulties in terms of committee review and transparency with respect to this document, primarily because the 2014 appropriation budget bill column 2, there's actually reduced funding embedded in that column. And it is not going to be readily apparent to you from this document. If you've spent any time in this budget document, you simply cannot see where that reduced funding has been applied at a unit level, much less an object code level. The budget division did prepare a set of separate CE sheets, is what they're called, but effectively they're the tables that appear in every single unit budget. They're representative of the figures in unit budget. And we've provided that PDF document just this morning to your staff, but that document reflects where the reductions appear in the 2014 appropriation, and it reflects that by object code. So
let me see if I can explain it and see if I explain it right. So in most budgets, column 2 is a biennial number, 2 years. And in most budgets, that's what we call the net to zero through that develops through the Chapter 17 process. So during the summer, every agency meets with your budget folks, and your analysts then determine what dollars out of the last budget were ongoing and what were not ongoing, and you build a standard budget, which is column 2. For the biennium. In this instance, because the budget bill actually gave us a hard number for the second year of the second fiscal year of the biennium, we start with that number, which is the hard number out of the budget. And then I take it then column 3 is where the department has asked for reallocation among that money. So that's simply saying, since you gave us a target, you also gave us the ability to flex things around. So these are our first round of net to zero flexes. They just move from one area to the other. And then you have the IT consolidation, which we know about. And then you have the supplemental budget requests, which are this would include, with $74 million, it has to include the Medicaid option in, I assume.
Mr. Chairman, your description, with the exception of the very first part, the conversation related to Chapter 17, was accurate.
Okay.
You are correct in stating that Column 2 is the hard appropriation that you made for 2014. You can tie these numbers back to the 48B appropriation contained in the appropriation.
And 48B refers to the
2014 appropriation for the Department of Health in the appropriations bill.
Gotcha.
The balance of your description is accurate.
Okay.
The other consequence, because we have embedded reductions in column 2, the other consequence that you'll see is not every unit that experienced reduced funding coming out of the 2012 budget session is reflected in this budget book. because our system only reflects units that are impacted in some way, shape, or form with a change. And so, for instance, there will be units that actually experienced a reduced funding as a result of your action in 2012 budget session that don't appear in this book. So the CEs that we provided to your the unit sheets, tables that we provided to your staff will reflect all units in the Department of Health and will reflect those that received a reduction as a result of your appropriation in the 2012 budget session.
Now,
does that make sense?
How thick are the CEs and have they been distributed?
They have not been distributed, Mr. Chairman. We provided them electronically in PDF form to your staff. I believe they're going to be uploaded to SharePoint, I assume.
Okay. All right. Well, with that in mind, we'll come back to the budget when we get back in 30 minutes.
And Mr. Chairman, it's 112 pages in length. It's only the tables, so there's no associated narrative with it.
It doesn't sound like it's going to be that helpful for us other than for our staff to know what you did. Okay, well then, at the end of the day, when you're going to markup, you're just going to have to figure out what the gov's recs are and the bases, and you just move the gov's rec and go from there. It's not going to be that hard. But whether you work off of the budget sheets or whether Don prepares you another summary that said, here's gov's rec, this is the point from which you work, either way, it's easy once you get there. Once you adopt that. With that in mind, three of us, I think, have been asked to go to another presentation. We'll be back. And, Rosie, you've got it. And then I think go over the...
Question before we leave this. This sheet here that you presented us, yeah, and that's going to show the budget reductions that we had for 2014 that's reflected in column two, correct? But we don't see them there, but we know they're on here. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bebout, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Have fun, guys.
Our apologies. We have a mini legislative session going on this week in Cheyenne. So the damage is occurring early. Mr. Forslund, if you'd go ahead first and introduce the folks with you today, and then we'll go through your presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk about some what we feel are some very significant issues for the state of Wyoming, and be happy to present those to you this morning. But before I do that, I would like to introduce to the committee, so those of you who might not know, some of the key members of my senior staff. I have Lee Claybots, who's the deputy director for the Department of Health. Lee. Bob Peck, sitting next to me, is the chief financial officer for the department. We have Chris Newman, who's the head of the behavioral health division. Terry Green, who is oversees the health care financing and Medicaid program for the state. Dr. Wendy Braun, who is the senior administrator for public health and also the state health officer. And then April Getches, she is in charge, senior administrator in charge of aging for the department. And finally, Meredith Acey is in charge of our policy analysis unit. She is on maternity leave, so I have Jesse Springer filling in for her this morning. So that's the key members of my senior staff. And as we discuss the budget, if it gets very deep in particular areas, I will call the respective division administrators up to get into the issues in a little more depth for your. Now, I was asked by the chairpersons for this committee to present a summary of the Medicaid expansion report. And we issued, actually before we did that, the governor had asked us to take a look at the Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, and look at the opportunities for potential savings if we implement it. Also look at potential downsides if we implement it, and to put together a report. We developed that report and we released it publicly last week. You were all given copies of that report, as well as the Labor Committee was given copies of that report. I was asked to go over that with you this morning, and so what we have done is prepared a PowerPoint presentation, of which you all have a copy. This is what it looks like.
Mr. Forslund, did you bring extra copies for the public or anyone else that needs? Does all of my committee have a copy to begin with? I just want to make sure before we get started that everyone has what this looks like. And if any of my new members need a copy, please raise your hand. Unless you're all, Dan needs one, okay. Eli, how are you doing? You're on the iPad. You're on your cloud. Okay. Anyone in the public need one? We have extras.
Madam Chairman, also besides the PowerPoint and the full study,
right. We
also gave you a kind of a two-pager. High-level summary, so you all should have copies of that. And that's just, instead of wading through a large report,
right. This
gives you kind of the highlights of it. So that was provided to you just for your use for in the future.
Okay. Everyone, check your box. If you don't have that, raise your hand, and we'll see if the staff has extra copies or we'll get some made. I'm sorry. I just know that you all need to be on the same page, so... He needs.
Carol, grab Phil's for me.
Carolyn, you want to take this and make some copies for us? Make enough so that we have for the rest of the committee and a few for the public. Okay.
Here's.
All right. So we're gonna. Are we gonna start first with the? Phil and on Phil's desk too. Yep, and then me. There we go. Okay, everyone good? And then public. All right, Mr. Forslund, I think we're on the same page.
Okay, and then I will only be working off of the PowerPoint. In 2010, Congress passed an act called the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act and the Health Care and Education Reconciliation Act of 2010. These acts were commonly referred to as the ACA. One of the main goals of the ACA was to expand health insurance, or basically health care coverage, which people have interpreted as insurance coverage. And it set out to do this in four components. One is individuals were required to purchase insurance, and this is called the individual mandate. Secondly, certain employers would be required to provide insurance coverage for full-time employees. This is called the employer mandate. Thirdly, the establishment of health benefit exchanges. And essentially that's an online system where people can go and compare private insurance coverages and then select their respective, the one they think is best for them. And finally, the fourth one of this four components is the expansion of the Medicaid program. So those were the four major components of the ACA.
Tom, are you okay to take questions
Sure.
periodically? Senator Meyer.
On requiring a certain employee participation, what's the threshold in which employers are exempt? So everybody knows that.
I think it's, is it 50? 50.
50. So anybody that employs 49 or less, they're not required to purchase insurance for what employees?
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, that is correct. Now, I will state right now that I am not an expert on the Affordable Care Act. I can focus on the Medicaid, but once we get beyond the Medicaid, our in-house expert is Meredith Acey, who, as I mentioned, is on maternity leave. So as I told Senator Nicholas, is my knowledge of once we get out of the Medicaid program is significantly less. So I will do the best I can, but as we go through here, hopefully we can stick closely to the Medicaid and not to the other components, but we'll do the best we can to answer the questions.
Have you developed anything that I guess, informs employers about what their responsibilities are so they know they're not crosswise of the ACA, or have we thought about that yet?
Senator Meyer, no, we have not. Again, the Department of Health has been tasked with the Medicaid expansion component of the ACA.
Thank you. Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Madam Chairman.
Moving on, as soon as the act was signed by the president, lawsuits started to be filed across the country. Many questioned the constitutionality of the ACA, especially the individual mandate. The individual mandate requires everyone to have some type of insurance coverage, and there was a lot of feeling that that was unconstitutional, and so numerous lawsuits were filed across the country. Several actions and issues were heard by the lower courts throughout the country, and ultimately the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case and limited it to four issues. Those four issues that were presented to the court questioned, first of all, does the Anti-Injunction Act bar action from being heard by the court? Secondly, is the individual mandate constitutional? Three, if it's unconstitutional, could the individual mandate be severed from the act, but the rest of the ACA expand or stand? And finally, does the ACA Medicaid expansion requirement exceed Congress's authority under the spending clause? Interesting enough, that last component received very little kind of national play, and most of it centered on the other questions. Well, the Supreme Court, moving on, issued its ruling in the National Federation of Independent Businesses, et al. Versus Sebelius, Secretary of Health and Human Services, et al., on June 28, 2012. And while the court upheld the individual mandate as a constitutional exercise of Congress's authority to tax, to the surprise of many, it struck down the Affordable Care Act's requirements that states expand their Medicaid programs. Specifically, the court ruled unconstitutional the penalty set out by the ACA that would be imposed upon states that did not expand their Medicaid programs. The Supreme Court's decision prevents Health and Human Services Secretary from penalizing states that choose not to expand their Medicaid programs by revoking or withholding existing Medicaid funding. this decision by the Supreme Court is interpreted as making the ACA Medicaid expansion optional. So essentially, that way it's where it's been left since the end of June is all 50 states have the ability to decide whether or not to expand the Medicaid program or not. And so that's what will be facing you in your upcoming session. And this is, again, we will go into now kind of the specifics, particularly as it relates to the state of Wyoming. So moving on, currently we have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of us were in D.C. last week and went to some forums on this. And one thing I think that's misstated is we were told that anyone that's below 100% of federal poverty level is exempt from the individual mandate. Is that something that has gotten back to the states yet?
Madam Chairman, Representative Escobel, that is the way that HHS is interpreting it. So those people under 100% will not be taxed.
Just want to make that clear.
Do you have a question? Representative Walls.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. But the whole individual mandate, is that not tied to employment? So if you're employed in a company less than 50 employees, then if you are 101% of the poverty level, both you and your employer are then taxed? How does that work?
Madam Chairman, Representative Wallace, a person at 101% will be required to have health insurance. It'll either be provided by the employer or they will be eligible to receive a federal subsidy through the exchange to buy private insurance.
Representative Moniz.
As far as the employees go, the 50, is that full-time employees or part-time employees and full-time employees?
Representative Berger, it is full-time employees.
The reason I ask that question is a lot of employers may be forced to convert a lot of their full-time employees to part-time employees to avoid the mandate.
Madam Chairman, Representative Moniz, you are correct. There will be employers who elect to move some of their employees to part-time. There will be employers that elect to just drop health insurance coverage as an option and have their employees go into the exchange. What they will end up being then is those employers will be taxed for not providing that insurance.
A follow-up, sure. Madam Chairman. In that case, the tax on the employers may be less than what would cost them for the insurance. Is that right?
Madam Chairman, that is correct. At this point in time, if you do a cost-benefit, most employers will find that it's cheaper to have those people receive the subsidy than provide the insurance directly. What a number of employers will have to decide is it in their interest to not offer that coverage? And, you know, will that impact their ability to attract and retain employees versus not providing the coverage? And that will be a individual or company by individual company decision. I'm sure most people anticipate that if a large number of employers elect to drop coverage, that the tax on them will most likely be increased over time.
Yeah, go ahead. Follow up.
I doubt that this is the case, but, you know, in some other instances where taxes are collected, AML comes to mind, there is a portion that is returned to the state as the state share. I don't suppose that there's, once that tax is collected, it just goes to the black hole in Washington, D.C., and we never see it again?
Madam Chairman, Representative Wallace, what the response from Washington would be is that tax is being returned to the states through paying for people who are on the Medicaid program who were not on before.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also, to be clear, that if an employer chooses to go that route that Representative Moniz spoke of, then they are not eligible for the small business tax breaks that they would otherwise have gotten if they were participating, correct?
Madam Chairman, Representative Esquivel, that's correct.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just for FYI, I attended a seminar at Johns Hopkins University this fall, and the chart that it covered, it was entitled The Affordable Health Care Act, Fact, Fiction, and Implementation. Awful lot of fiction out there. One of the things in one of the charts that I had captured was that the proportion of employers offering health insurance has increased in Massachusetts. Massachusetts implemented RomneyCare, which is virtually identical to Obamacare, with the Band-Aids, by the way, and it has shown that Massachusetts has the lowest rate of uninsured in the nation at 2%, and it showed where employers are actually seeing that it's a benefit, and they have actually increased since the implementation of RomneyCare.
Any other questions before Mr. Forslund moves on? Go ahead, Tom.
Madam Chairman, now we're going to be moving to Wyoming. And essentially, at this...
That is a really good thing.
last estimate that we had was 83,000 individuals in 2010 were uninsured in the state of Wyoming. Of this 83,000, approximately 30% have incomes but below 138% of the federal poverty level, which would make them eligible for the Medicaid expansion due to, and this is going to be a little bit of confusing, and so I would hope that I can explain this clearly, is the Affordable Care Act talks about people at 133% and below of poverty level receiving, being eligible for Medicaid. However, there's an additional 5% disregard on their income. So if you take the 5% disregard and add it to the 133%, you come up with 138%. So sometimes you'll see 133, sometimes you see 138. It's exactly the same, just a matter of one has the 5% set aside included and the other one doesn't. Approximately 51...
Representative Stewart and then Wallace.
Madam Chair, thank you. Tom, could you give us that in dollars, please? What does 138% mean in somebody's income?
Yeah.
Yes, that 100. And break that down, Madam Chair, with that 138 to 400% as well. So I can kind of put that into some kind of context, Mr. Forslund.
Madam Chairman.
Do you have a chart on the federal poverty level?
We are gathering that right now.
That'll be fine. Let's keep moving while we can continue the discussion. That was Sue's question, so we'll just keep going. And then if we need to get a copy of that, if someone wants to just get it to our staff, and they'll make a copy.
Okay.
Okay. Go ahead, Tom.
Approximately 51% are between 138 and 400%. These people would be eligible for federal subsidies through the exchange. So again, 30% or up to 138% would be eligible to go on to the Medicaid program, assuming full expansion. 51% of this population would be eligible for subsidies through the exchange, and approximately 19% are over the 400% federal poverty level and would not be eligible for Medicaid or for federal subsidies, but still be required to have insurance. So that's the breakdown of the estimated 83,000 people that that we estimated in 2010 who were not insured in the state of Wyoming.
Tom, somewhere in your presentation, are you going to go through in a little more detail as far as the rules on the exchange and who can purchase insurance through the exchange, or should we ask questions now?
Senator Meyer, we're going to have a discussion on insurance exchanges when Senator Nicholas comes back.
Okay.
It'll be brief,
right.
And the Labor and Health are actually working on that.
And Madam Chair and Senator Myers, I mentioned to Senator Nicholas before, is the Medicaid expansion issue of the ACA was tasked to the Department of Health. The exchange was tasked to the Commissioner for Insurance. So without Meredith here today, and without anybody from health or from the insurance office, we can't get very deep.
You are totally in a different environment. All right.
Apologize for it, but it just has not been tasked to the Department of Health.
But those things are being worked on, and we should be getting reports as committee members. Okay, go ahead, Tom.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, Senator Bebout.
Tom, on the 19% of the 83,000 that are about 400%, they have no insurance. Is that the way I interpret that? Is that correct?
Senator Bebout, that is correct. It's 83,000 people estimated in 2010 with no health insurance. So those people above the 400% federal poverty level have elected for whatever reason not to buy insurance. They either self-insure or take their chances, and so that is correct. That's 19% of the 83,000 with no coverage.
And those people that certainly can afford it will be mandated to do it, correct?
That is correct. And if they don't buy insurance, then they will be taxed.
That's probably most of the young people that feel they're invincible. That's, I understand.
I wouldn't doubt it. Okay, moving on. In order to discuss the detailed impact of the ACA and the Medicaid eligibility, we really need to understand who's currently eligible for Medicaid, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding on who is eligible for Medicaid today. And eligible people today must meet two requirements to be on Medicaid. First of all, they need to be financially eligible, in other words, low income. Secondly, they have to meet a categorical eligibility. And so Wyoming has four primary eligibility categories. That is children, very low-income adults, pregnant women, and individuals who are aged, blind, and disabled. So what that means is, regardless of your income, if you don't fit one of these categories, you do not get Medicaid coverage. I think a number of people think if you're low-income, then you automatically can apply for Medicaid, and that's not the case. You have to meet one of these categorical requirements plus be under the federal poverty level.
Tom.
That's the 100% federal poverty level or 138% federal poverty level?
It depends on which category you're in. And it can go up to 133% or 138% if you're children, Others, it drops down to, I believe it's 28% of federal poverty level. So it depends on which category you're in. And I had that listing, and I dropped it off because I thought no one would be interested in that area. So what do I know?
With JAC, you never know.
Well, I was trying to summarize this as best as possible. Next, there are two groups that are the focus of the rest of our discussion today, and that is of whether or not Wyoming participates in the optional expansion. The first group is called the required coverage. We have to provide it to individuals, whether we expand or not. And there's two groupings in that called the woodwork and newly eligible children. The second one is the optional expansion, which is essentially childless adults. These two groups then will be detailed in the following, the rest of the presentation. Let's start off first with the woodwork population. Because of the individual mandate and increased attention brought to the health care coverage caused by the ACA, it's presumed that individuals who are already eligible for Medicaid but not enrolled today, for whatever reason, once the individual mandate kicks in 2014, they're going to say, oh, I better get coverage, and they will come on to the exchange, find that they're eligible for Medicaid, and sign up for Medicaid. The common industry term is the woodwork population. They'll come out of the woodwork and sign up. And these individuals are required to be covered regardless. And we get only a 50% match on these people because they're already eligible for the Medicaid program as it stands today, but they haven't signed up. Once they sign up, we are required to cover them, and we will only receive a 50% federal match for these woodwork population. Is that clear? So there again, there is no option on this. These folks are required to be covered.
I think I understand exactly what you're saying, but we're talking about the extremely low-income adults, children,
aged,
pregnant women, aged,
blind
and
disabled
individuals out there now that would materialize.
Madam Chair, Representative Wallace, you're absolutely correct.
Okay.
They're there today, and for whatever reason, lack of knowledge, don't want to be on the program, whatever, they have not signed up.
Yeah, Madam Chairman, so those are already out there, but they haven't elected to come in. What's the cost going to be when they actually do come in, and we have to do that because it's 50%? Is that reflected in our budgets as we move forward, what that might be?
Madam Chairman, Senator Bebaugh, that is correct. It will have to be in the budget. That's one of our supplemental budget requests for you, and we'll get to the actual numbers in here. But that is one of the reasons why we have a supplemental request before you today.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Director Forslund. I think that, you know, people tend to get caught up in what the impact or costs associated with the ACA and Medicaid expansion. But there's another component to this that I'm hoping you're going to cover, and if you maybe don't have it today, that I'd like to see at a future time, is the cost of doing nothing. And what it, if we continue down the road, what it costs us today, what it's going to cost to do nothing, and compared to what the working with the ACA.
Madam Chairman, Senator Hastert, I am not covering that in the PowerPoint today. However, it is covered in the report, and it talks about, in effect, uncompensated care costs incurred by the hospitals of the state of Wyoming. And on a yearly basis, the figure, the most recent figure we have, is it cost just shy of $200 million for one fiscal year, one calendar year, for hospitals. Essentially, what's happening is people without health insurance who suffer a medical emergency can receive care through emergency rooms in the hospital, and hospitals then have to eat those costs. So what they do then is take those costs that they've had to absorb, and then they pass it on to full-pay patients through increased rates. Essentially, it's known as cost shifting from uninsured to the insured. Okay, moving on to the next group of required coverage, and this is the newly eligible children. Essentially, the ACA requires the existing Medicaid program to add children ages 6 to 18 whose family income is between 100 and 133% of the federal poverty level. Currently, these children are eligible for KidCare Children's Health Insurance Program, or better known as CHIP, but not Medicaid. And so they're on the CHIP program today. They're not on Medicaid. However, with the implementation of the ACA, these children will be switched over to the Medicaid program. And this group of children, again, is not optional. It is required. And this group is not affected by the Supreme Court decision. So they will be coming on to the Medicaid program. However, this group will still be covered at the 65% federal match level that they are currently through the CHIP program. So again, it's not 100%; it's 65%. So essentially, that is the same there for this group for at the beginning of the implementation. Okay, moving on then. Our best guess for these two groups is shown on the next slide. And what we did, per the request of the legislature, was commissioned a study this last year. It was called the Medicaid Cost Study. And we hired Milliman Company, which is an actuarial group, to take a look at best guess estimates on the numbers of people who would be coming onto the Medicaid program and best guess estimates on how much these people would cost, based on their age distribution and how, based on past experiences with people coming on the program. They did an actuarial analysis, and they gave us this information, and it's online at our website, the Medicaid Cost Study, it's called. And so through this group, or through the Milliman, they gave us the estimates on the woodwork is 3,700 people would be coming on, newly eligible children 6,900, total is 10,600. So that's our best guess at this point in time that will be coming on the Medicaid program. The state of Wyoming has no choice in this decision, and we have to put it in the budget, and we have a request before you for this population. And this is for the first quarter, basically. It'd be the second half of fiscal year 14. So 6 months' cost is in the budget, supplemental budget before you this morning. Next year we'll be coming in for basically 2 years worth of costs related to this population. Okay, now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Director Forslund, that expansion to the children, the FMAP goes up to 88% in 2015, correct?
Madam Chairman, Representative Escobar, that is correct. Now we'll go into, we just got through with the required group. Now we'll go into the optional group. And this is what a lot of people, when you start talking about Medicaid expansion, this is the group you're talking about. But for a lot of people, they're thinking all the people we've been is optional. And I just went through what is not optional. Now we'll go into what is optional. Under the ACA expansion, Medicaid coverage would be available to all non-Medicare eligible individuals under the ages of 65 with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level. We think there is approximately 17,600 people who would meet this category who would sign up for Medicaid if it were eligible to them. I refer to this population in many respects as the working poor. Essentially, they're adults under the age of 65 who are old enough that they are beyond the coverage that provided by their insurance, by their parents' insurance. So those people 26 and above, people who are part-time jobs, people who are working multiple jobs, but they do not, their employer does not provide insurance, because we're not talking disabled because they're already eligible. We're talking about essentially in most respects is the working poor of the state. So we think there are approximately 17,600 people who would be coming on to the program.
Madam Chairman? Just a quick question. Tom, where did the estimate come from? What formula or how did you pick the estimate?
Madam Chair, Senator Perkins, this came again through Milliman's report to us from the Medicaid option study. They gave us a range that was from here to here. They covered themselves very well. However, then, and then essentially they said, this is our best guess, but it could be as low as this or as big as that. And so we have used the best guess provided to us by this actuarial group.
What was the maximum? It looked like over there that the simple math was 30% times 80,000.
Jesse and Terry, would you get pull that up so we can get that the range for we will get that number. Moving on, with this expansion population, the federal government will cover 100% of the costs for this group for 3 years, 2014, 15, and 16. Then it ratchets down to, as you see there, in 17 down to 95%, all the way down to 2020 and beyond at 90%. So essentially the federal government pays 100% of the cost for the first 3 years, ratchets it down over time to 90%. Now this is a concept that you need to keep in mind is the federal government says there is no deadline for states to decide whether to expand or not. You can expand a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, and it's up to the states when they expand or if they ever do. However, if they expand and you delay the expansion, the FMAP rate does not float with you. It's in place on these years only. So if you elect to expand starting in year number 4, or basically 2017, the FMAP at that point in time will be 95%. So then again, the question is, well, why is there that larger FMAP rate in those early years versus later? And the reason is it's pent-up demand. It is consistently shown across the country, both in private insurance as well as Medicaid, and it's also the case in Wyoming, is when somebody comes on to the Medicaid program, there is what I call a lot of deferred maintenance. In other words, there is work that needs to be done, and people have held off from going to the doctor, going into surgery because they can't afford it. So suddenly when they have coverage, then they go in and they get the repairs done that they need to. So the when the people come on the program early years, those costs are significantly higher than later on average. And so essentially the federal government says, we're going to pay for that pent-up demand for those first few years, and then we're going to ratchet down to 90%. If you elect to defer and come on the program later on, you pay for those pent-up demand. We're not going to pay you 100% at that point in time. Okay, moving on. Senator Meyer, going back to your question before in terms of the range, and did you find it? For the others, the low number is 11,500, the large number is 22,900. And so they said best estimate was 17,600. Okay, the next page shows, again, kind of a summary of the numbers under the Medicaid program. 3,700 for the woodwork, 6,900 for newly eligible children, the expansion adults, 17,600, for a grand total of 28,200 people under this program. So from here, we're going to move on to cost. Turn our attention to what the cost of this of these are. This first one shows both the federal and the state general fund costs for each of the group. On the woodwork population, again, these come from Milliman's, from the actuarial study, is the woodwork cost for to the federal government's $53,300,000. For the state, $53,300,000. Remember, and this goes back to the FMAP. Remember, this population are the ones that are coming out of the woodwork who are already eligible. There is no enhanced match for those. So every woodwork person coming on board, the feds will pay 50% and the state will pay 50%. So next one is newly eligible children. Remember, again, the FMAP rate is difference between the federal and state. So for the required population for a whole year, the cost for the state would be $99 million, for the 7 years is $99,900,000, or essentially $100 million that we have to budget over the next 7 years to pay for this estimated population. The optional population goes down, as you see there, $738 million for the feds and $35.7 million for the expansion. Again, people say, well, I thought the feds were paying 100%. It ratchets down over that 7 years from, starting at 100% and ratchets down to 90%. And so there is the cost there. So for them, then for those 7 years for the state, that's $51,200,000. So the next page just gives you a overall summary for that 7 year time period. It's be $151 million for the state's general fund. If you do both the required and the optional expansion, and then the feds would be paying $864 million.
Director Forslund, why did you choose the 7 years, and are these figures per year or average over the whole 7 years?
Madam Chairman, Representative Wallace, 7 years was selected by the legislature. The legislature, through the directive to us, is to estimate the costs over a 7 year period of time. And I think they probably selected that because that's the time period that we ratchet down from 100% to 90%. I'll show it to you on a yearly basis as we get into this in a little more detail. Okay.
Madam Chairman, I was just going to look. I mean, if you look at that number that the feds pay, that $737 million, I mean, basically that we're getting our AML money back.
Madam Chairman, according to the analysis done by the Department of Health using the Milliman enrollment and cost estimates, and the Wyoming Department of Health concluded that only covering the required population will result in a net cost to the state of Wyoming's general fund. Covering both the required and the optional groups will result in a net savings to the state. So you question, how can that be? And the reason is expanding Medicaid to optional groups will allow greater offsets to be realized. And expansion to all groups gives the states the opportunity to reallocate existing expenditures. The term that we use is offsets. So the next section of the report goes into offsets. When we talk about offsets, we're not talking about cuts. Essentially, we're talking about repurposing or reshifting, reallocating existing funds from existing programs away from those existing programs into the Medicaid program. The state has created several programs over the years to serve those individuals who do not have insurance, and they are paid for with 100% state general funds. And so people without access to health care coverage still have been able to get some services through the state of Wyoming, paying 100% of those costs. Why the state elected to do that over the years, I can't tell you. Most states have not done that. Most states have elected to bring some of these people onto the Medicaid program earlier, paying for those costs through their Medicaid program. For whatever reason, the state of Wyoming elected not to do that over the years and have paid for it with 100% state general funds. Some examples of those are colorectal cancer screening. You have directed us to provide colorectal cancer screening to 500 people per year, low-income individuals. Now, with the implementation of the ACA and the Essential Health Benefit Package that will be offered through private plans, these type of coverages will be available to people with private insurance at no cost to them, because it will be paid through the insurance, or through, if you're on Medicaid, Medicaid will pay for that. And another one is behavioral health services. This is an example where the state of Wyoming has, the legislature has appropriated significant money for mental health and substance abuse, and it's the second largest item in the Department of Health's budget. And what we do is, bulk of that money is we send out on a yearly basis to community mental health providers as well as substance abuse providers. We give them essentially block grants. And what an example would be is that they will provide a service to an individual, be whether it's full, they're not in under the poverty level. They can be above it, they can be below it, but they'll provide those services to those individuals. And they pay for, they're able to do that through block grants from the state of Wyoming, Department of Health, and again, it's the second largest item in my budget. What we would propose is to start moving these agencies that receive block grants over to a fee-for-service model. So they would be just like any other private provider out there, be it a psychiatrist, psychologist, hospital, a physician. Right now, those people bill for services on an individual basis. And so instead of getting a block grant, these organizations would now start to move towards fee-for-service, and they would bill private insurance for those people above 138%. For those below it, they would bill Medicaid. And so that way, then, we would be able to take the money away from the block grant program and put it over into the Medicaid program. And recognizing that all of the money that goes to provide mental health and substance abuse would not be eligible for insurance coverage, we say we're not going to move 100% over. We'd only move 50% of it over, and the other 50% would be paid for things like wraparound services and other mental health and substance abuse services that would not be eligible for Medicaid that's being provided. So we would continue to provide that to these organizations, but the other 50% would be to be put into the Medicaid program, and then we'd ratchet it down over 3 years to help them to change their business model around from basically a block grant model over to a fee-for-service. So we would help them make that conversion. So that's just as an example of some of the things that we would do in order to be able to free up money from the existing programs we do in order to pay for this area.
Tom, I think when we begin to help to transition these folks over, and had a good presentation from Peak Wellness, basically they're not set up to deal with insurance companies and codings and all of those things to the extent that a private provider is. And I'd like to have you guys work with the insurance department to come up with some simplified coding category, so when they get into the billing process, that it makes this as simple as possible, because, you know, frankly, the coding process and insurance reimbursement, the whole thing needs to be reworked so providers know that they're going to get paid and individuals know they're going to get the services paid for. And so it's a bigger problem than just working with the mental health aspect of it. But as we're transitioning over to that, and I know we have to, because those services are paid for, and I think you correctly realize that, and I applaud you for moving in this direction, but these guys are going to need quite a little bit of help out in the field. And I think we're going to have some more detail and more understanding about what can be switched over to private services and what has to be repaid. The 50% is, I think, a nice throw at the dartboard, but I'm not sure if it's exactly there or not. So it's going to take, I think, 2, 3, 4 years of sorting out what's going on. And I believe those mandates for insurance and wellness benefits are covered in all insurance policies, just not the Medicaid optional folks. So they're going to have some people coming through the doors they never had before, but I think we've got some heavy lifting to make that part of it work.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, we recognize the issues that you're talking about in terms of that transition will not be just a easy, quick process. My discussions with some of the providers have been is we get it. We understand why it needs to change. In fact, if we don't change, essentially we could potentially be able to be compensated twice, a block grant plus be able to bill private insurance. And so we need to make that transition, but you need to help us. And so we have committed that, one, we would provide some type of assistance through training, to bringing some people in to help the individual companies, organizations kind of retool their business model. And so we want to provide those services, kind of that consulting service or help fund that consulting service help up front. Secondly, then we propose on stepping it down over a three-year period. So it won't just be January 1st, 2014. It'll be over 3 years. And you'll see that when we go in there is the savings in those first few years is not as great because we would be stepping this down over 3 years. In terms of the coding, we are somewhat restricted in Medicaid on the coding and what we're required to comply with through CMS. But in terms of trying to assist. We recognize it. They need help, and we want to do that and make it as painless as possible. Okay, moving on. Medicaid, we examined the cost for required and optional coverage over the 7 years. And as mentioned, we estimated cost to the state $151 million. We've identified $198,500,000 in offsets. So the cost minus the offsets generates a savings to the state. And if you look at page this next page, it gives you a breakdown by year.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On the 198.5, I'd just be, not right now, but I'd be interested if I could, I don't know how many pages that is, but I'd just be interested in looking at that. Your 100, the 100, just for my own curiosity, where the 198 came from, so. That's just on some point in time. Thank you.
Madam Chairman, Senator Perkins, that information is in the study. And so it has it detailed in, I think it's the appendix, that goes through the 198 by program. Yes. Yeah, I think it's in front of you now also in hard copy form.
Don, Ms. Richards, do we have all of that populated now into the iPads for SharePoint for the group?
Madam Chair, it is also loaded on your iPad under the calendar and in the file directory.
Good. Thank you.
If you look at the next table, this is the table that shows the required coverage. And if the state says, the legislature says, we're only going to do the required coverage, you see, we think there's still some offsets even if we only do the required coverage. And they're listed by years on that. And so you see that we, over those 7 years, we think we get around, you know, $20, $21 million worth of offsets versus the $90 or $100 million cost in coverage. So it's going to cost us on an average of, you know, $10, $12 million a year extra through the Department of Health's budget to pay for this increased cost due to the required population coming on board. Moving on to the next one, it's got a combination of required and optional. Again, as you see in those early years, we're seeing some smaller savings because of the step down that I was talking about. But then over a period of time, it shows a net savings to the state over those 7 years of approximately $47 million. If we do 100% of the expansion. And again, remember in those first 3 years at a 100% cost reimbursement from the feds and then ratchets it down. So the next one is just basically a summary, as you see, is total costs $151 million, total offsets $199 million, or roughly $47 million in net savings to the state. So again, bottom line now, the legislature needs to make the decision whether to expand for the childless adult population, that working poor population. That is your decision. And so I'm not here trying to advocate for, advocating against. I'm presenting a report that the governor had asked for and your leadership had asked me to present to you, and be happy to answer any further questions that you might have.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Tom, and when I look at the savings that you've analyzed and having the option to come back into the program at any time down the road at those other percentages where the federal government reimburses at those levels, it kind of makes sense if you're concerned about the feds ever, you know, changing the whole plan later on and saying instead of 95%, it's going to be 65%. you know, my level of trust for the feds is not like it used to be, if it ever was very good. So does it not make sense for us to be a little cautious early on because the net savings early on are not substantial enough based on what might happen to us? Because once you get into it, you can never get out. So would it be, if you were going to take the conservative approach, you'd sort of on the front end wait a little bit and see how this thing shakes out, because the savings initially aren't nearly as much as they would be later on.
Madam Chairman, Senator Bebout, a couple issues there that you raised. First of all, the federal government has said you can come in on this optional group anytime you want to. You can leave anytime you want to. So it's an option to go either way at any time. Secondly, in terms of the cost, is why there's less costs in the early years, or savings, excuse me, is because we're ratcheting it down. In other words, we're not implementing it overnight. We're working with those providers, particularly those mental health providers, to transition them over a three-year period of time down to full moving away from block grants to fee-for-service. So any time, if you delayed it a year or two, we would still want to be helping them ratcheting it down. So it's a moving, yeah, so if you delay 3 years, you're still not going to, you're still going to have smaller savings unless you say don't help them over that 3 years, just implement it right away. And so that won't generate the savings that you're thinking of because of that ratcheting down to help those, particularly those mental health and substance abuse providers. And I'm not sure if I was clear on that. The other thing is as I have I've been asked the question before, is, well, wouldn't we be better off, or excuse me, once you bring these people on, there's no way we can ever get out of the program. And I've said, well, first of all, legally, we can, as a state, we can withdraw anytime we want to. The feds have already put that out, that you can withdraw anytime you want to. One way to protect the program, if you want to call it that, is you put into statute wording that if the feds ever change the 90% match, then the expansion automatically goes away, versus if they drop back on the 90% match, you would have to go in and take action to drop it. So, in effect, it would be a trigger that if they ever drop the 90% match, the program goes away, then the legislature would have to take a proactive move to keep it in place, versus a proactive move to end it. And so that is one option for the legislature at least to consider. The other thing I've been, people have said, well, what if the federal government doesn't honor that 90% match long term? And I said, it's no different than they can, what to make them honor the 50% match long term. It's just simply, all we did as a department to say, this is what the law is today. I can't project what the law is going to be tomorrow. I can say what the law is today. But again, there is, if you're looking for guarantees, there's no guarantee they're going to keep the program as at 50% match any more than it is keeping them at 90% match.
Currently, Tom, population of childless adults is not covered under Medicaid. And my question is, would it be possible to cover the optional adults up to 100%, or if we cover that optional population, do we have to go to 133%, or can we go to 110% on all the eligible, new eligible people? Yeah. What option do we have in between the whole 133 and nothing?
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, a number of states were interested in covering the population from 100% and below, and they wanted the 100% and above to be put into the exchange. And so that, so between 100 and 133 plus set aside is they get the federal subsidy. They're not on the Medicaid program. They would get only get the subsidy. And so they made the request to HHS for that that waiver, that flexibility. Secretary Sebelius came out with a ruling, if you want to call it that, this week, that says that HHS does not have the authority to grant that request. They only, so essentially states only have the option of providing the whole population or not any of it. They don't have the flexibility of cutting, you know, we're only going to do the 100% below and not 100% above. You do it all or you don't do it. So that ruling came out on, I think, Monday it was.
Director Forslund, I'm trying to get a handle on the offsets from a block grant to a pay-for-service or a fee-for-service, how that works, how you arrive at that. And then I think I'm hearing that the insurance company then is going to pick up the tab for this. Is that right, or am I misunderstanding this?
Representative Moniz, the situation is that starting in 2014, everyone is required to have health insurance coverage. So a person coming in to, again, we're just talking about the mental health area right now, facilities. If a person comes in and they have private insurance, the private insurance will be required to have pay on parity for mental health services. So those individuals who have private coverage will be able to pay for the service they receive at the counseling services. They'll be able to bill private insurance companies for their services. Those people who are below, certainly below 100% poverty level, will not have health insurance coverage. Because under the law, if, and this will go into the exchange and the ACA a little bit more, is if the state elects not to expand, the federal government will allow those people between 100% and above to get a subsidy. Those under 100% will not be eligible to receive a subsidy. So they're just out of luck. They will not have health insurance, private coverage through the exchange, and they will not be eligible for Medicaid. So they're just out of luck. They will have no coverage at all. Those people above 100%, if the state elects not to receive, expand, they will be eligible then to receive a subsidy through the exchange. So, again, those people 100% and above will have private insurance, and they'll be able to go into the mental health organization, get a receive their counseling, and the mental health organization will be able to bill those private insurance for the for their services. Now, if we elect not to expand, then we have to keep the block grants in place, because those people under 100% will have no coverage. They won't be able to pay the bill. They'll come into the mental health and substance abuse organizations seeking the services, and if we were to cut off funding through the block grants, they would have to either not provide service to them, or they've had to figure out how to cost shift some way in order to do it. They're going to tell you they can't afford to do that. So the state will have to continue to provide the block grants to those organizations in order to keep them functioning and be able to provide care for those individuals under 100%. Did that answer your question?
I think so. I'm trying to get a handle on how the state has a net gain here, and who's somebody's got to be footing the bill for the difference there. Is that the insurance companies that are picking up the tab?
Representative, it is the insurance companies or Medicaid. So, bottom line, make it real simple, instead of the state paying 100% of the cost for many of these programs, by shifting it over, the state will be paying only 10% of the cost because the feds are picking up the rest of the cost through increased FMAP. And so either private insurance, which are required to provide those services, or Medicaid. So the services are going to continue to be provided. It's just a matter of it's going to be paid for by insurance or Medicaid instead of the legislature saying, Department of Health, flow this money through to these organizations and they're as block grants. Instead, we're going to say, no, we're not going to flow it through as block grants. You're going to start billing for services just like any other private provider does, and we will reimburse you on a fee-for-service basis as opposed to a block grant. So the services will still be provided. They have to by law. But instead of the model that we're under right now, it would be a new model of funding, private insurance or Medicaid versus 100% block grant paid for by the state's general fund. And again, if the state says, no, we don't want to expand, then what we'll have to do is continue with the block grants, but then also ante up another 10, 12 million plus a year to pay for that required population again, not have the ability to do as much, convert as much of these services over to that fee-for-service model. We'll have to stick with the block grant model.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Director Forsland, I want to go back to the discussion that Senator Bebout brought forward and the discussion about the option to go in and the option to go out and the possibility of the state statutorily establishing some trigger mechanism that says if the federal government reneges or reduces the amount that they would be contributing, that we would simply opt out. But I'm really compelled by the argument for proceeding with caution, because I think what that means in reality, the impact that would have on people's lives, is that you have now developed a whole population of people who are dependent on the system for what they need, and if we had that automatic trigger, suddenly they're out, and you're really affecting people's lives drastically at that point. Wouldn't that be the case?
Madam Chairman, Representative Wallace, you have to understand those 17,000 plus people today have no health insurance. They're out there and they are living day to day with no coverage. If, in fact, you gave them coverage for a period of time and then took it away and say, well, we're going to be negatively impacting them, the question you'd have to ask yourself is, are those people better off for having coverage for 3, 5, 7 years and then not having it anymore, or just not having coverage at all for that same time period and hoping that they don't have any medical emergencies during that time period. Or if they do, the hospitals have to eat those costs and pass it on then to other insurance providers. So it's not a situation where people have had this coverage for a long time and then it's goes away. They don't have coverage today. And so if you have them there for a short period of time and they get coverage, is the quality of their life better for that time period? Even if you take away later? I mean, that's just a question you'd have to answer for by yourself.
I think my point is that we as a legislature would be under horrific and probably insurmountable pressure to pick up that tab, that we would be backed into a corner and the state would then be pretty much forced to provide those things. I'm going to toss out another situation. I am one of those uninsured people. The reason I'm uninsured is because I've made that conscious decision for myself. Because as an unemployed rancher, the cost for my insurance alone is 3 times per month what I have actually paid in health care over the past 5 years. Now, I've decided that for my personal finances, it just made more sense for us to deal with that in a different way. So now the state, I don't know, it just bothers me that we are assuming so much, and I guess I'm going to, I realize that there's some savings possibilities here, but I'm really feeling like the fly in the web at this point with the spider approaching, and I think that's true for us as a state, that this is a very sticky situation for us to be in, and there's lots and lots of pitfalls.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Director Forslund, earlier in your presentation, you mentioned uncompensated trauma care. The figure, the $200 million figure, that's per year in the state of Wyoming?
Madam Chairman, Representative Escobel, that is correct. That was a figure 2 years ago. The hospitals said that it has gone up in the last year. I think it's 211 or something like that, but I'm not comfortable throwing that one out, so I threw out the 198, which is they have to report that to us on a regular basis. So that is a one-year cost to the hospitals of the state, of which then they shift that uncompensated care costs over to full pay providers. Interesting enough, there's kind of two components of that. They both deal with cost shift. The first one is those people with no insurance, and they're in there. There's a medical emergency, and they have to provide that coverage or that care, excuse me. The second group in there is, which kind of surprised me, is what's going on in the state today is another cost shift, and the cost shift is employers are cost shifting their costs onto employees by increasing deductibles, increasing copays. And so what the hospitals are finding is even with people with health insurance coverage, they can't make the copays and the deductibles. So they have to end up eating that cost also. So it's the the people with no coverage as well as those who can't make the copays and deductibles.
Follow up, Madam Chair. The cost savings in the PowerPoint is 47.4, but that's only within state programs. The uncompensated trauma care part of it, that the state at a reimbursement rate that we also pay for, isn't reflected in the report anywhere. So the potential cost savings of uncompensated trauma care decreasing, but more people being covered would raise the amount that the state would show as a net savings.
Representative, or Madam Chairman, Representative Escobel, you are correct. We point some of those items out in the full report. However, I wanted to stay away from these other potential savings or potential positive impacts because I didn't want to be accused of trying to embellish and coming up with squishy numbers or others. I wanted numbers in there that is under the control, frankly, of the state government. And so, we move into costs or cost savings to not only hospitals but to other health care providers. Other states have included the additional federal funds coming in and what that does in terms of increased money coming into the state's economy and potential job growth and the turning of the money in the state. You can come up with all kinds of numbers to get it bigger and bigger and just open yourself up to a charge that you're inflating these numbers. It's really not true, and we just said they're there, but we're not going to try to build it into our analysis, and you all can determine the extent that you want to factor them into your thinking or not factor them in.
And then one final question, and it's more on the insurance side of it, Madam Chairman, that in the ACA, insurance companies are required to now provide, I believe the figure was 85% of premiums collected toward direct health care costs, and that goes into effect in 2014, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes, it is, Representative.
Well, then, that would be my point, is that at that point, that's probably when you would see more uncompensated trauma care decrease as well, because at that point, you would also see deductibles and premiums start to decrease. That's what we saw in Massachusetts anyway.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Esquivel. And Mr. Forslund, we're going to take a JAC 10-minute break.
That means 25 minutes.
Madam Chairman, just one thing is this sheet here was just simply a two-pager summary of everything I just went over.
What else was on?
We turned everything off. You command.
Right. Yeah, this.
Everything in the room was off except for this one?
Correct.
How come I'm not getting the next
one? Those are from Kurt Myers.
What about the wireless? Where's the wireless?
Okay. He switched. He's using the wireless now.
Yeah.
You want it back?
I wonder if she'll make some
extras.
Oh,
wait.
No, we're not.
My wife asked if she could not make any Christmas presents. It's just been very heavy. We have a number of things.
Oh, I did not touch a thing. Matter of fact, I came in here to do something, and I told him, I said, I better wait until we do
so. So she decided she wasn't going to make any Christmas presents. My mother-in-law is not coming for Christmas. It has the designs on.
Don Agar, would you do me a favor and turn her microphone on the hearing table real quick?
This weekend is her birthday. So now, we want to be there for mom's birthday. So now, they expect this program.
Would you like me to speak into it?
Wonderful birthday.
And the other one, too. And I'm speaking into it.
Good.
There. Okay, let's get going. What happened to Rosie now? We lost Rosie. Well, let's get started. The Director, I've got, and I apologize if some of these questions were answered, but I suspect their areas were sort of covered, but I think there's some things that we need to be thinking about, and the JAC needs to look on both sides of this equation. And I think fundamentally everybody believes the notion that once extended, the hand of aid can never be withdrawn but with impunity. So the idea, the concern is, and a part of the reluctance is it's easy for you to say, and you invoke the program, you take the aid, and if 4 years from now the money's not there, you shut it off. And the people are better off having received 4 years of benefits of health care, and they're healthier. So you haven't lost anything, and you can shut it off. The concern that almost all legislators will have, and I think the overwhelming concern, is that once you extend the hand of aid, you cannot withdraw it. We know by experience it's more difficult to withdraw something that's extended. Having said that, fundamentally what I struggle with, and that is, what is the impact of doing nothing, and how does it affect our health care providers, our health insurance plans, and the people of Wyoming? And you cannot start off with the premise that 1,700 people are receiving no health care service. Our assumption is that they're receiving health care services, but they're not paying for them. That it's not as though you're working in an environment where the free market system develops it, because the free market system has been interrupted, and hospitals are prohibited by law from turning patients down because they can't pay. So these folks are receiving some kind of health care services, particularly if they're emergent, or it drives them to the hospital, and it's very expensive health care, and those costs are then being shedded off to those of us that do have health insurance, because we're paying for it by cost shifting. And from the state of Wyoming, being one of the largest providers of health care insurance in the state, we're paying it through our health care, and presumably, to the extent that we're also providing Medicaid dollars for, that's the cost of our Medicaid patients, some of that's cost shifted too. So we pay a Medicaid price for somebody, and the price that's provided to us is a cost that has embedded in it an overhead that includes uncompensated care. So If the advocates for the health care expansion for the 1,700 Wyomingites are accurate, the notion is that it should be almost cost neutral. That is, these folks are having health care services being provided to them, but it's being cost shifted, and we're going to put in $50 million and you ought to see a reduction of $50 million equivalent health care in the system, because we're simply creating more transparency, but we'll put in $50 to cover what is now uncompensated care, and everybody else, including the state of Wyoming, private carriers, will all see a reduction in their health care costs of $50 million, because you will no longer have to cost shift. So I guess my first question is there any way for us to know, I mean, through Dr. Gardner's work or otherwise, to know whether or not that premise is accurate? I mean, I think you're reluctantly staying away from it because nobody wants to predict it, but could we do an analysis of, with data that we have, that this population, this 1,700 people, are receiving an equivalent amount of $50 million, and so we would expect to see a $50 million decrease in health care costs in other areas?
Mr. Chairman, you're correct that we stayed away from those type of projections as well as a number of others that we could not, you know, absolutely, you know, say we have control over and that we are comfortable with it. With that said, could we make some type of projection? Probably. I mean, the hospitals have to report to us on a yearly basis their uncompensated care. Uncompensated care, as I was mentioning earlier, is not only those individuals that you're mentioning who come to the emergency room in critical condition and need that type of emergent care. It's also private companies that cover individuals, provide health insurance coverage, but they've cost-shifted some of their costs onto their employees by increasing deductibles and copays. So, and then the employees can't afford those, so the hospitals are having to eat those costs too. So, you know, if we could say, you know, this is the uncompensated care portion where there is no insurance, and get that number working with the hospital association and groups, and say, okay, a portion of that will be covered now. This is what potentially would be in the system, you know, as savings. We could come up with that, but as any type of this type of projection, I would say some people will question the validity of it, the numbers and such, but sure, we could play with it if that's what the committee wanted.
Well, let's take even the family practice residency center. So I suspect we may find that a substantial number of the 17,000 people are going to the family practice residency centers. They might be going to your community health centers that we're all paying for. And if they had insurance, I mean, arguably, we're putting, say, $20 million plus in each of those centers, and if they were all insured, we'd see a $40 million. You could see $40 million of income. The so then, I mean, if there was a mechanism to, for us to know that by taking the $50 million, we would see a savings of $50 million to our other budgets, and such it was actually cost neutral, so that if we ended up taking over the system, all we did was cost shift the $50 million so that, for example, family practice residency centers now are paid for by insurance payments, and they're no longer general funded. I mean, if we had a way to identify that and to track it and to make it happen, it makes a different proposition if we know it's revenue or cost neutral to us by just saying, okay, we're going to cost shift. So I think there is a challenge out there to say, look, is there a way that we can know and demand and insist $50 million? Now, if all we're doing is throwing $50 million more into the system, that's going to be gobbled up by physicians, hospitals, healthcare providers, and so that their incomes go up, I don't think anybody's interested in that. But if we actually knew there was cost shifting, and the total dollar spent remain the same and we see savings, it's a different decision. And I think part of the challenge is there a way for us to say, okay, we will do this, but we expect to see $10 million savings in each of our budgets to the family practice residency centers. We expect to see $10 million here and monitor it and insist on it. The second thing that this goes to is that we met with it. We were with you and met with healthcare providers around the state. A Blue Cross Blue Shield representative says he thinks that the consequences to them are significant if Wyoming does not do what he considers this cost realignment. That is, right now their premiums are based upon cost shifting that exists. So they pay X dollars for hospital care, of which a substantial component is uncompensated care that was cost shifted to their room rates. He described, and I wonder if you can describe for me better, because all I can give you is the gist of it. The gist of his concern is that part of the Affordable Care Act is another component that comes in and looks at insurance companies, looks at the rates they're paying, and if they're picking up uncompensated care, there may be a penalty to them in terms of how they calculate their premiums, and maybe a requirement to reimburse policyholders because they're overpaying for services on account of the cost shifting. I don't know that I understand it, but they're scared to death that if we don't do this, that they're not going to be able to. They're going to be forced to continue paying for cost sharing, but there's going to be a penalty assessed to them for cost shifting, but there'll be a penalty against them for paying those higher rates because the federal government will come in and say, hey, we're going to look at your cost, your premiums paid, but we're going to take out cost shifting. And if that by taking that out, it looks like you've made too much, we're going to penalize you. Do you understand the argument they are made, and can you explain it? Because that's just the best I can do to describe it.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, the issues that we've been presenting, I've been presenting this morning, are the cost that is totally under the control of the Department of Health, of where we can reallocate existing funding within our budget, move it over to the Medicaid program, and pick up all the costs of the expansion. And the net cost to the state will be zero. In fact, we think that it will be a positive $49 million over 7 years, only within the Department of Health by reallocating those funds. That's totally under our control, and that's what was presented. You start moving away from the Department of Health and looking at other potential savings. We can come up with guesstimates, but it's not under our control. We don't control rates charged by hospitals. We don't charge control rates by other providers. So, again, it would be a estimate, but I could not, in effect, guarantee it. In terms of what you're referencing, the regards to Blue Cross Blue Shield, first of all, I would suggest that you address some of those more technical insurance questions to your Department of Insurance, because they're the one tasked with the implementation of the ACA and the exchange and that side of it. The Department of Health does not. That's not part of our task, and it's not that we've spent a lot of time looking at. As I mentioned earlier, Meredith Hasey was with the governor's office. She became probably the foremost expert on ACA for the state. And unfortunately, she's on maternity leave right now. And so she's not here, so I cannot defer to her. So what I think that is being referred to, and this is just is a guess, is the requirements that insurance companies have to expend at least 85% of their premiums, in effect, on health care coverage. And so if, in fact, they're incurring other costs and it falls outside of the 80%, they have to pay basically back to their providers or their subscribers as a rebate. And I would assume that's what he is referencing when he says that. But, again, I'm not the best person to answer that question, and I would suggest that you talk to the Department of Insurance when they come before you and talk about their budget.
In your presentation, are you making – you say there's about – we're taking about $50 million if we were to opt in for the 17,000 coverage. Is that right?
If you go to the latter part of the report – of the not the report, but the PowerPoint – it's on my 28, page 28, is it? And what it is, it says ACA required an optional coverage costs. And you have a listing there by year on what's required coverage, whether the state expands or not. We're going to incur approximately $100 million in additional costs to the Medicaid program over 7 years, the general fund, that we're going to have. The next line is the optional costs, which is $51 million. Then we project that we can repurpose, reallocate, however, whatever you want to phrase it, existing funds within our budget of $198 million, $199 million. So, in effect, we can extend coverage to 28,000 people through the Medicaid program at no additional general fund contributions by the state of Wyoming. If you don't do the expansion and you only do the required group, you turn to the page prior to that, and it shows that we'll have a net cost of approximately $79 million because the offsets will not be nearly as large. And this is all within the Department of Health's budget. And so we have complete control over that.
Now, that's what I want to make sure I understand. So are you telling us that, look, ignore the federal government, we would be better off to put in the, what's the total dollars we would receive from the federal government for the expansion? That's when you look on page 28, which of those columns represents the amount we the state would receive for the expansion group?
We need to go back to page 19. And that shows a breakdown of the cost to the federal government for the required grouping as well as the optional grouping. That's on the first column. The second column is the general fund costs. So for the required, it costs, it will cost us just shy of $100 million for those 7 years. For the expansion, it's a $51 million. So the bulk of the costs all rest with the required group for the state's general fund. And the reason being is there's a much smaller match, the federal match rate.
What I'm reading then is if you, the optional coverage is the 737.8 plus 51, so the total dollars spent are $780 million.
Well, you turn to the next page. That shows you the summary.
All right. So when you talk about the cost savings of $47 million, it's taken an investment of $860 million to get there.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm.
Well, what I'm trying to do is evaluate what it costs. I'm just going back to my question. Is it cost neutral? And that is, are we simply shifting cost? But if we're putting in $860 million between us and the state,
no, the federal
actually closer to $900 million.
The federal government's putting in $864 million. The state would put in $151 million. So we're talking about roughly a billion dollars here.
So if we put in $1 billion, then your total budget savings would be $47 million.
Yes, because we feel that we can come up with $199 million of repurposing, reallocating existing money within the department over to contribute to this $151 million. So we think we can come up with, like I said, the $198.5 million in offsets to cover the $151 million in costs.
Okay, so then that was part of your point that annually we get reports that there is uncompensated trauma care of what, $200 million a year?
Yes.
So over that same period of time, if all that trauma care was covered, so there were people that had insurance. Over that same period, you'd see $1 billion worth of savings. Presumably, then the hospitals would lower their room rates, and we would see benefits.
That would be benefits to providers. Being the state would be the largest, or one of the largest, if not the largest, through the state health insurance program, as well as, all the other providers out there would be able to charge for those services then. What I'm talking about here, none of that is calculated into these costs.
Well, I understand that. But I'm trying to figure out, I'm not focusing right now on the 17,000 folks that are uninsured. I'm focusing on the health care providers that allegedly are going to now save money that is presently cost shifted. So the question I have, and that is, if we put in $1 billion, will we see $1 billion of savings that will fall to all of us who have insurance, to the taxpayers who are subsidizing hospitals that are losing money, or whether or not we just put another $1 billion in the system, and it went to drug manufacturers, it went to makers of CT equipment, it meant, all the equipment, and the hospitals now have an extra reserve of $500 million 6 years from now, and none of it reached the pockets. So have any of the states said, look, we would do this if we can ensure ourselves that for every dollar that went in for the 17,000 people, we're going to see a reduction in private health care, is uncompensated loss. Obviously, trauma, I think a lot of that trauma care is on I-80, and some of those folks aren't even from Wyoming. You get these massive bills for people that are on car accidents, but a lot of them are Wyomingites. And so my question is, I think you can't ignore the fact that every year we've got $200 million of uncompensated trauma care. And that can't continue. And what the federal government may say is, we're going to start adjusting your Medicaid reimbursement rates on the assumption that, or on a premise that we're not going to allow cost shifting. And if you don't want to play the game, that's fine, but we're not going to reimburse you for higher rates that are based upon cost shifting. So I still would like to know, I think there's a consequence to not doing anything that we're not evaluating. And ignoring that could be dangerous if we if all that what's happening is, look, we're going to go to universal health care and your reimbursement rates are going to be set on a premise that everybody's care is compensated by some source and cost shifting is not allowed. And I guess, are there states out there that are trying to say, okay, we'll do this, but we're going to create a czar to go out and make sure that those savings are in fact go to prevent cost shifting, so the room rates will decline, that we won't see $200 million of uncompensated care, and the money doesn't just simply go into health care providers' pockets.
Mr. Chairman, I understand your question. I do not have an answer to it. We have not done that analysis, nor have I seen anything that other states have looked at. I'm not saying they haven't. I just haven't seen it.
The question then is that if we wait a year, are there states that are going to implement it that will be able to see what in fact happens to their rates? Is there advantage to waiting at least a year, watching those states that have experience and see how whether or not they start reducing their premiums and they start seeing savings, or whether they just injected another $1 billion of care for every 17,000 people?
The federal government allows the state to come in to the program for the expansion group anytime it wants to. It can leave anytime it wants to. The issue is the FMAP rate is 100% for the first 3 years to address the pent-up demand costs that you incur, and then it ratchets down to 90%. So the longer you would delay coming into it, then ultimately the smaller the FMAP rate is. But it's entirely up to the state when it wishes to come into the program.
Trying to balance out these numbers here on your caveats on your alternative budget, and you say that the budget freeze spending limits don't apply if there are significant Medicaid enrollment increases due to a slowing economy, then in parentheses say over 2,000 people over 4 years. However, we already know there's 3,700 people that you say most probably will be coming on through the woodwork. So I'm trying to understand whether that 2,000 number starts counting at 3,701 or it starts counting at 1.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, we haven't gotten into that alternate budget proposal yet, but when that was put together, the assumption was that's due to a slowing economy, not due to Medicaid expansion.
So would it count at 3,701, or does it start at 1? If you start counting and you make the case that there's a slowing economy, let's take that as a supposition that that's the case. There's a slowing economy. But you already know there's 3,700 people coming on. You expect that. So does it start at 3,701 or does it start at 1?
It starts at 28,000 plus 1.
28,000 plus 1. So at 28,000 plus 1, then you'd be able to start counting your first for your 2,000 in your alternative budget.
Yes. I mean, the idea was that if the economy started tanking and suddenly our unemployment rate went up significantly, it would be very difficult to be able to absorb those costs. And so we set an arbitrary number saying that just through normal growth, we could absorb, but significant as a result of the slowing economy, you know, we would come back and ask for additional funding. But that would be a total disregard of the expansion numbers or the increased numbers due to the expansion, both the required as well as the optional portion.
Thank you for making that clear, Director.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Forslund, just to back up a little bit to your numbers on the optional coverage and kind of maybe broadening the perspective a little bit beyond just the state dollars to the perspective of a taxpayer. You know, I understand the $47 million in savings. Your numbers, and I know this is sort of beyond what you did, don't talk about any savings on the federal end and savings of federal tax dollars as a result of the expansion. So if you just take the dollars spent as kind of outlined here, you could say, well, if we throw in the federal dollars of the $737 million on optional, you know, that 40, we have to spend an extra three-quarters of $1 billion just to get $47 million in savings, if you understand what I'm saying. And so have you looked at all whether there is anticipated savings on the federal side or not? And if you're looking at it as just as the pie of tax dollars spent, then and beyond just the state interest, does it make sense to spend that much money to get, you know, $47 million worth of savings on the state side of things?
Madam Chairman, Representative Stupson. We looked at it from two perspectives. One is if you don't expand, one if you do expand. If you don't expand, there is no net savings. It's a net cost. It's going to cost the state of Wyoming additional, you know, $12, $14 million per year. Because of the required population that's coming on board. If you do expand, then we're able to reallocate funds internally within the department, and it won't expand the Department of Health's budget. In terms of the federal government, if we don't expand, they're paying essentially half the costs, roughly, and we pay half the costs. If we do expand, they pay 100% of the cost of the expansion population for 3 years, then it ratchets, it's down. So, you know, saying in terms of spending almost $800 million from federal funds to get a $49 million savings for the state, I guess I look at it differently is the state can elect not to expand and spend $10, $12, $14 million more a year and say, okay, we elected not to provide coverage to those 18,000 people, and we're prepared to pay an extra $12, $14 million a year not to provide the coverage. Or we can say we'll provide the coverage and we'll just reallocate existing funds within the Department of Health's budget to do that. And the federal government is going to pay their respective match either for, you know, just the required group or the required group plus the optional group, and it's up to the states to make the decision. And you can come in anytime you want. You can go out anytime you want to, but here's the FMAP rate, and take it or leave it.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Forslund, I guess just to follow up on that. I mean, the thing I'm thinking, though, is if I'm thinking in my head, again, not looking at just state dollars, looking at tax dollars, just all the tax dollars spent, and I'm thinking that it's going to take an extra expenditure of $737 million to get to that state savings. I mean, is that an accurate way to think about it, or am I off base?
The $738 million is the federal share of that expansion group, and so, I mean, if you're looking at from just simply a dollars and cents taxpayers on a broad sense, is taxpayers of this country can save $738 million by not expanding.
$1,000.
No, it...
Well...
It's going to cost us $100 million
right.
To cover the required group. The state won't have to spend that $51 million in match. However, we'll still have to continue to pay for almost $190 million worth of program costs that we can't divert over because that population at 100% and below will have no health coverage. And so consequently, those services, if we want to continue to provide those services, we'll have to spend that 190 some million dollars regardless. If you elect to expand, then you can stop providing that funding and move it over, and that's where you get the savings.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Tom, I want to talk a little bit about the offsets, and you had those four primary categories that we have, and so you're being really creative in how we can get the $198.5 million coming in the offsets if we buy into the expanded Medicaid coverage. My question is, you know, what is the certainty of that? Do they require waivers from the Washington to be able to do that? Do we know or have a relatively high assurance that they will happen? And it seems to me that all the other states will probably be looking at similar things like this. So in the end, the federal government, when they anticipated the cost of this program to them, these offsets that we gain will be more money that they will have to spend because of the ratios and how they spend their money. So you have kind of an end run on this whole situation in terms of the total dollars spent. But I'm more concerned about if we do this, go into the expansion, do we know for sure that we will be able to get these offsets because of waivers, or is it just something we can do? How would that work?
Madam Chairman, Senator Bebout, you said four, and those were just examples. If you take a look at the back of the report, there are significantly more than four programs. But with that said, the bulk of the money, over 50%, I think it's 60-plus percent, is coming from mental health and substance abuse. Almost all of these programs that we're talking about, in terms of the large dollar amounts, are 100% state general funds. The federal government has no say over that. And the state of Wyoming is somewhat unique in the respect that many of these programs, and particularly in the mental health and substance abuse area, the state has been very generous with its general funds to pay for these services. And other states have either not provided the service, or if they have, they've put it as part of their Medicaid program and got the 50% match. For whatever reason, Wyoming elected not to do that. So in the short term, it guess that costs the state more money. Long term, it gives the state more flexibility to reallocate or repurpose those funds over to meet that match. And so we don't need permission from CMS or anyone else to say, can we repurpose the mental health substance abuse funding divert it over to do the Medicaid match. In fact, the federal government, as they were discussing this in the past, have talked about offsets, and they anticipate some offsets, but I don't think in the case of Wyoming we just have more offsets that because of the decisions to pay for things 100% with general funds.
Let's just assume for a moment that Cheyenne Medical Center, 50% of their appendectomies are emergent and are not paid for. Let's just assume that. I'm sure it's not true, but let's assume it. And so half of the appendectomies don't get paid for. As a result, your room rate is set at $300 a night, and your charge through for your physician care is set at $10,000 procedure. You're paying $10,000 for every paid procedure, and you're charging $300 for the paying rooms. Now let's assume for a moment that the current administration hits a grand slam, and let's assume that Colorado elects to come in, and they've got the same ratios, and now that everybody's paying, they reduce their room rates to $150 a room night, and every appendectomy now is $5,000. So that what actually happens, instead of adding money to the system, what they're doing is cost shifting. What's the likelihood that, you know, what's the impact of on Cheyenne Medical Center, if they've employed the doctors and everything else, when they still have to charge $300 a night for their room rates and $10,000 for the appendectomy, when you can go to Pooter and do it for $150 a night and a $5,000 procedure because they took the money?
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, that was a point that was made yesterday when I was making a presentation to the coalition of businesses who have formed to deal with health insurance costs. I mean, this coalition of employers around the state are concerned that their cost of health insurance, whether it's insurance or if they're self-funded, is increasing at a non-sustainable rate. And so they have come together to see what they can do about trying to deal with ever-increasing costs of health insurance and what controls can be put into place. And as employers who are paying a significant portion of the bill, what can they do as a coalition, as a group, to try to influence it? And so they had asked me to present this report since it came out publicly this last week. So I presented. And they were asking, after it was over, they were asking the same question that you were just asking, but in a different way, is if you are a road contractor and you are bidding somewhere on the fringes of the state, and you are competing with companies that are out of state that have less expensive health insurance, and one of the reasons is that those states have done the expansion and Wyoming hasn't, that is this going to put them at a competitive disadvantage? And so the employers were talking about amongst themselves is what influence or what impact will this have on us if the legislature elects not to expand and in terms of our competitiveness. I don't think anybody can say that today, but it's certainly in the minds of people beyond just you in terms of what other states are doing and what that does to our competitiveness.
Bob, we asked you guys help to come in at 11. You might as well come back after lunch. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman. Director Forslund, I want to drill down into the offsets, specifically in the mental health and substance abuse area. As I understand it, everyone's mandated to have insurance, whether we pass this or not. That's correct. Right.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, yes, with the exception of those people who will be under 100%.
138% of the federal level?
No, 100.
100.
If you elect not to expand, those people between 100 and 133, 138 will be defaulted into the exchange, and so they will get a subsidy. It's those people below 100 who won't get the subsidy and won't have Medicaid. They just are out of luck.
Now, I'm trying to get an idea about this, because if that's the case, then those savings to the mental health and substance abuse are going to be, those savings are going to accrue to the Department of Health, irregardless of whether we take the option.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, no, in the respect that if we say no to the expansion and still strip the money out from the mental health community or mental health substance abuse, those providers will be all over you saying a significant portion of our clientele have no health insurance coverage, and you expect us to provide coverage to those people, but you've cut our funding. How can that work?
All right, let me tell you how. That the way I see it is that because people are mandated to buy health insurance, you're going to have more people with health insurance. And because there's a mandate within the ACA to provide mental health coverage for all insurance policies, that mental health mandate for coverage attaches to every insurance policy that you buy from today forward. And so all the thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that have insurance now, if they go to one of these mental health facilities, that's going to be covered by their insurance policy. And the 56,000 people from 138 to 400% of the poverty level or above, they have to have insurance where they haven't had insurance before. So when they go to these facilities, that's going to be covered by the insurance policy. The only thing I didn't take into account in this scenario is 138 below. So you're going to have the folks at the mental health and substance abuse centers across the state are going to have increased revenue from insurance proceeds because of the federal mandate for mental health insurance coverage. And that's where I see you have some overlap as to whether or not we pass this or we don't pass it. Now, is that a correct assumption?
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, you're absolutely correct. And those people from 100% poverty level and above will have insurance coverage, and due to mental health parity requirement on the ACA, they will have coverage for mental health substance abuse services, and you will be able to say you shouldn't have as much money through block grants. But the debate you're going to experience, I anticipate, I predict, is they'll say we still need just as much money because of those people under 100% to cover those. And so you're going to have that tug, you know, a war going back and saying, well, we can cut you this much, and they'll say, no, you can't cut us.
Right.
But you're correct in your assumption.
Can we look at the total offsets there of $120.7 million, and can you tell us how much of that is under the 100% and how much of that dollar figure is derived from the mandated insurance coverage with the mental health parity above 100%?
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, no, I cannot. So you're going to be relying on the data they give you when you make that call.
Could you? I guess you could proportionalize it, assuming everybody has the exact same mental health needs on a per capita basis. And I don't know how close. I mean, that's a guess. But if you've got how many people under 100%? That's not the 17,000. It's less than that, isn't it?
It's less than that.
It's less than that.
We have the estimates, you're correct. You know where you're headed. I know where you're headed, and you're correct in doing it. But I will not be able to provide the data to this committee, to the legislature, to say this is the percent, this is the number that you can cut. And so you will be having that discussion.
It'll be in excess of the $12 million that we'd have to pay that we were talking about, I'm assuming it would be well in excess of that $12 million, that you would save at least that, and the Department of Health should be able to make those offset adjustments without any increases in funding.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, that would not be a decision made by the Department of Health. That would be a decision made by the legislature. And that would be what the majority of you determine is the proper allocation.
Madam Chairman, what I'm getting at is I'm trying to make a determination on offsets as to what's directly related to our passage of the Medicaid option expansion and what's directly related to the passage of the ACA. And they're two different numbers, and we've got them all lumped together. And I think to make an informed decision that we have to get those numbers split apart.
Well, all you can ask is can you make a reasonable allocation? And if the answer is no, the answer is no. I debunked a couple of assumptions in there. One assumption is that everybody will have insurance. If you're in part of these 70,000 folks and it costs you $1,200 a month to get insurance, you're going to take the tax penalty, which is pretty insignificant. That's not going to get you insurance. Simply saying you have to have insurance doesn't get the insurance. And part of the whole issue of if you accept the current administration's proposition is that if we do all this, everybody's insurance rates drop. It'll be easier to get insurance. But if you're not participating, you're not going to see dropped insurance. And you look at what most of us are paying for our health insurance, you got to have money to pay the premium. And otherwise, you take the tax penalty and you just don't pay your taxes. Big deal. So I guess, Kurt, I don't mind putting staff or requiring them to make assessments based upon your hypotheticals, but I don't know the hypothetical is accurate enough to warrant the amount of staff time they would take.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know there should be a way without too much problem, at least to make a determination about the current number insured now and what that result is in the current hard numbers of people that we have insurance and apply the mental health parity mandate to the insurance policy, because we know how many people are insured in the state of Wyoming. We know for a certainty that a pretty good estimate about how many of those folks need mental health services, and whether or not we pass this expansion or not, how much money would be flowing back into the mental health and substance abuse centers without the passage of the increased coverage. That would give us a hard number with hard numbers, relatively easy. It wouldn't give us the whole picture, but it would give us a number that would allow us to determine what that offset would be. And I think that's a relatively straightforward formula without going through a great deal of staff time.
Tom, do you know what he's asking for, and does it make sense to you? I mean, what's your assessment of what you can provide with reasonable staff time?
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, we can do a very elementary analysis. Essentially what we would do is take the percentage of uninsured estimated who are below 100%. And then put that up against the cost savings or offsets and just do a percentage, between 100 and 138, it'd be this percent. Under 100% would be this percent, and put it up against that dollar amount that we're putting into mental health and substance abuse and say, this is what you could potentially do on offsets. But at the end of the day, it's a policy call. It's not a formula driven, it's a policy call. And I know the mental health associations, and they're going to probably question the validity of that simplistic analysis. And with just what you're throwing out and other things, well, everyone's not going to have coverage. And these people below 100% cause us more time and effort, and et cetera, et cetera. So at the end of the day, it would be a policy call made by the legislature to say, you will do this, and you would have to then work with those providers. But, yes, we can do what he's talking about.
Here's what I'd like you to do, because if members of the JAC want to ask for reasonable things that you can do with reasonable time, I want to make sure that's delivered. So do this for us, please. Just provide us what you call the rudimentary assessment. State that you're asked to do it by the Joint Appropriations Committee, and these are the assumptions. And based upon that, here is a rudimentary analysis of what could look like, and you're free to put all the caveats you want. And then if the healthcare providers want to come in and add their list, they can do that too. But so if you can do that with a reasonable allocation of time and it's helpful to Senator Meyer, then go ahead and do that. And you're free to put all the caveats in and explain that it was based upon our request. If you begin to do the analysis and find out it's going to take you 100 hours of labor, let us know and we'll release you from the request.
We'd be happy to do that.
And I think I need to explain about what actually I'm asking for, because I don't see it in the report. And Tom, what I'd like to know is to determine what the offset is above that $120 million. And those are the people that are currently insured that don't have the mental health parity. And I'm sure the insurance department can say there's, you know, 186,000 or 244,000, whatever it is, that's currently insured. And if they had the mental health option, which they do now, it's mandated, that dollar figure on offsets isn't in this $120 million.
Well, Kurt, you'd have to know two things. You'd have to know how many people, how many policies are out there that they can tell you how many policies are issued because they're getting premiums off of it.
Right.
They probably would not have the analysis who's providing currently. My policy covers those care right now. Most of us are covering that. So your analysis would have to be on a premise that how many policies that are not currently covering it will now have to cover it. Because that would be the change. You're looking
for
a
change. Yeah.
And fair enough, if the insurance company, if the insurance commission has that information, that's okay. I'm doubting that they have the information to know which policies in the state are offering mental health care coverage.
Approximately 7% of the revenues for mental health and substance abuse right now is from insurance proceeds. And that's a number that's basically a good number. That number is going to go up. And to really understand whether we expand this project or not, is we have to make a determination on the offsets and whether how hard some of these numbers are in the offsets. And we're going to get some, I think, a lot more than $120 million offsets to the mental health and substance abuse because of the folks that currently aren't covered. Now,
My concern isn't so much that you're asking for the information. My concern is that we're going to task the department to get useful information, and if it comes back useful, I want to have it. But you keep introducing new elements that they don't have control over for the research project, and you may send them off doing 35 hours of work and come back and say, we can't deliver on it because you got too many unknowns. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, I'll work with the department and with the insurance department and try to get us a little bit more flesh on these numbers so
okay.
We can understand them.
So you'll work with the department, and Tom, you assign somebody to work with Senator Meyer, but at the same time, you have to let him know and be candid with them to know how much time is being utilized to serve the request and what the probability of getting useful information is. So if it's a task that appears to be useful, then complete it if it's reasonable time. On the other hand, if providing that information, you say, look, we're chasing a rabbit, and we have other things to do. We still have the labor committee to deal with. Kurt, please release us from your request. Then, Kurt, you'll honor that, I assume, at some point.
Well,
say,
Mr.
look.
Chairman, I think we can get all this done with less than a couple of 3 hours between the insurance department.
Okay, well, you'll work with each other, but you'll honor their time.
Sure.
Okay.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, if after this meeting you will get with Jesse Springer, he is the young man who's going to be assigned this project, and to see if make sure that he understands where you're coming from, because I don't want to say it's a simple project. I can't say it's a impossible project. You need to help him understand what you're after, and then we can make that determination after we start doing some preliminary research.
And then what, Jesse, what we're looking from you then is if you can get the information, make it easy. I mean, don't just say, hey, it's too impossible. Try to figure out how to answer his question. But also be candid with him on how much time it's going to take so everybody's communicating, okay? Great. Ken.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just wonder, Director Forslund, if some of the what-ifs that are out there, some of those questions could be addressed by maybe using the Massachusetts model as a comparison. What happened to surrounding states when they implemented their version of the ACA? What happened to insurance rates and premiums and deductibles in that state? So I think that maybe what the chairman's asking for, that information is probably already out there, as well as what the Congressional Budget Office determined what the total cost savings were going to be to federal taxpayers on a whole if every state did implement the expansion as a whole, and what the costs were going to be if all states chose to not implement the expansion as a whole. So, you know, those are possible ways that we can address some of these concerns and what it's...
Again, when we speak... If that information is available and you've got it and it may be out there, work with us. And the other side of it is, Ken, we have our own staff. We have a lot of this stuff is available from organizations that we're members of. So to the extent that you have that information, but we're coming into a session and their primary mission is to serve the request of the Labor Committee. And JAC, we need to have information because we're going to do a markup. But you have to honor what their primary obligations are, and making them our research group is you have to just be careful. So what we're asking is if you have folks that have collected that information and have it available, then give it to us. If it's not available, Ken would probably believe that by this time you would have looked at those models, that there's publications out there that would provide ammunition for somebody that wants to expand coverage to say, hey, look, here's anecdotal evidence that we approve. So if you've got that, Director, please provide to us. And then, Ken, you can also talk to Don and have them find out who the analysts. I assume there's some analysts that have been within LSO that have been working on this information, and that they can call that up pretty easily. So I think it's great information to have, but here's my concern, that is I expect with JAC that we get all the information available, and the agencies worked hard to get our information. We have hard decisions to make. They have to give it. But we have to be judicious in what we ask for so that we're just not creating a bunch of information that nobody's going to read. So, with Director, if you have that information and there's anecdotal information out there, please provide it to us. If it takes an inordinate amount of time, let the co-chairs know, and we'll either release you from the obligation. And at the same time, Ken, you'll check with our our analysts to see if somebody's already done that or doing that, so we're not duplicating other efforts. And if Don, if you check with the analyst or the staff of the labor committee, if they've already completed that work and you've not, then there's no sense in having health go out and find information that's already been collected. I assume that Senator Scott's committee hasn't just been sitting around all year. I assume that a lot of this information may have been developed. And we've been sending people expensive seminars around the country to get this. I think it's actually Senator Bebout's next. And you? Yeah.
Go ahead, Drew. No. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Tom, my question is on the 10,600 that are going to be required, and assuming that we do not opt into the expansion, and since we're paying 100% on the mental health and substance abuse and some of those areas, will we in fact be able to go to the Medicaid and request that 50% match for those that we now have been paying 100% if we don't do the expansion? And is that a sizable amount of money, or is it not any number that we need to be concerned about?
Madam Chairman, Senator Bebout, I'm not sure if I understand the question. In terms of those people at 100, above 100% federal poverty level.
Madam Co-Chair, what I'm talking about is 100% state funds for mental health and substance abuse, that if we don't opt into the Medicaid expansion, we'll still be able to go back to the health, back to the feds and get 50% of that. It's something we haven't done before. Will we be able to do it even though we don't take the expansion? And maybe we should have been doing all along, like you said earlier.
Madam Chairman, Senator Bebout, no, we will not be able to. Now, those people above 100%, as Senator Meyer pointed out, they will be required to have health insurance, and they will be able to get a subsidy from the federal government to buy insurance. So those people going in, as well as above, you know, all the way up, those people all have health insurance coverage that requires them to have mental health parity. So those community mental health organizations will be able to bill for their services either to a private insurance, well, actually all of them would be to private insurance companies. And then we continue to provide a block grant to those organizations. Potentially we would be double paying for a portion of their population, assuming they are billing. Some of those organizations are already billing, and they are already billing Medicaid for some of their patients today, and they're still getting the block grants. So there is already some duplication with the mandate in place for insurance for everyone above 100%. I would anticipate more of that happening. The problem, though, is those below 100% will not have insurance and will not have Medicaid. So in order for them to receive services, if you don't expand, then they will need to continue to receive block grants from the state. Then, as Senator Meyer pointed out, is what's the breakdown between those who are under 100% receiving services there and those above 100% who will get the billing? And I can't answer that today, and I don't think I can, because we don't collect that type of information. We can do, again, a rudimentary guess. But if you don't do the expansion and you strip the money away from the block grants, then you put those mental health organizations in a precarious situation. Either they deny coverage or services to that anyone who doesn't have health insurance, or they have to suck up those costs some way, and I don't think any of them are operating that flush today. So the ultimately, when it comes down to it, it's really not a something to put into a formula. It's a policy call. The legislature says we'll continue to block grants at the same levels, or we're going to cut them back by some percent.
You want to ask your questions? You're good. Go ahead.
Madam Chairman, so what you're saying, though, is that we cannot today be able to, in any way, shape, or form, get to 50% of the federal Medicaid match for any mental health and substance abuse that we're now paying the block grant. That's what you're saying.
Again, it's those people above 100% will have insurance, and but below they won't have any insurance. So we're not expanding Medicaid population. Well, no, excuse me, between the 100 and 138%. No, they'll have private insurance. No, we will not be bringing in Medicaid.
Pat. Over here, and then I'm going to go to Drew. Who was over here? Who was it, Jeb, or was Jeb, you're on. And then we're going to go to Drew. Hey, too many people in the room? Go ahead,
Thank Jeb. You, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my question is a procedural question. The process, how do we pull this trigger to make a decision, go, no go on expansion or not? Is that done, Mr. Chairman, through markup as an amendment in Department of Health, or is this going to come as a bill, or is this has this been thought out, Mr. Chairman?
There is a budget request from the department to expand into do the Medicaid expansion through the budget. Governor has denied it. So the motion on the floor will be the governor's rec. All those in favor say aye on that issue. And if that's the vote, then that it is. I would suspect there's at least one or two members here that will make a motion to reject the governor's rec and go with the department's. And if that passed with a majority vote, then the staff would be directed to create an amendment, whether it be inside their budget or Section 300, to implement the vote. Separately and apart, I think that the Labor Committee may be out there doing their own bill. So you could have a conflict. You could have a lot of things happening. But this committee, should it choose and have a majority of all the votes, has every capacity to reject the governor's recommendation, implement the original request, or any modification of that if there's a plurality. And, you know, this committee looks at these issues a little bit different than labor. We begin to look at just the economics on the state. So it will be something that may take debate. I assume that there will be motions made. I assume there will be a difference of opinion. And what we want to make sure is that the people voting on it have thought about all the issues. Senator.
Never mind, Mr. Chairman.
No, go ahead.
Getting back, see if I can even remember my question. It was so long ago. I was just wondering, getting back to something I think might be a little bit less esoteric. I was just wondering, getting back to, as kind of going back to Chairman Nicholas's discussion about how can we, is there some kind of metric that we have that we can look at so that if you went down this path, or if another state goes down this path, that you can see, I mean, the concept is that overall, if everybody's paying a little bit of the freight, then the freight rate should come down a little bit for everybody through insurance premiums, through reimbursements, through all the other types of things. I think that's what the chairman was talking about. And so my question is to you is, your department monitors the cost of certain things, and we've done, there's a couple programs, for example, out there, like
colorectal screening and breast and cervical cancer. We've paid for those types of examinations for programs for 3, 4, 5 years now. And I'm just wondering, for example, if your department would know, as it sees bills coming in for those types of screenings, if those rates have either gone down or leveled, or if they have not increased like we've seen other rates. I'm just wondering if that type of information is available, if your department would have that. And I'm sure that you probably can't answer that question since you're here today, but I'm just wondering if I'm looking for types of metrics where you can see where you look at when we've taken on, or that we've paid for these and broadened the base that's paying, if we're seeing corresponding either reductions in growth or actually reductions in the cost of fee for services in those areas. And I'm just wondering if you can think of, or if there are areas that we could find that and see if that has ever worked. And
Madam Chair, Senator Perkins, we certainly have that data. And if there was a handful of procedures or so, we could put that together relatively easy on a 5-10 year kind of history of what those costs have done. We did as part of our Medicaid options report is took a look at our health care costs for Medicaid on a gross basis, global basis, and how much that went up over the last decade versus medical inflation for the state of Wyoming. And so we can provide that, but it's, you know, as Senator Meyer pointed out, there's hundreds of colds, so essentially it would be nice to have a handful of them that we could pull together to show you if that's what you'd like to see.
And Mr. Chairman, and the reason I'm asking that question, I was just trying to think if we could, if there, and I don't know. I mean, obviously, it would only be anecdotal evidence at best. But I'm just wondering that's the concern that you have, and I think it's a real concern. I think it's actually just coming at Representative Stubson just comes at it from a different direction when he looks about, you know, when we throw all this into it, is it really going to make any difference? And so, you know, I know it would only be anecdotal, and I guess the next question I would have you, if we looked at some of that type of anecdotal evidence, do you think that's valuable in even trying to extrapolate from that to a broader population that of data that indeed when we broaden the base, that we do see corresponding reaction by the marketplace that you would expect?
Madam Chairman, Senator Perkins, I think that's an excellent point, that we could put together a dashboard relatively easy to put certain indicators of costs, and if we elect to expand, we would have a pre and a post data analysis to see, in fact, if the market is responding. So we would determine if there were 10, 12, whatever indicators that we would monitor on a regular basis over a period of time to see how those costs are trending, and to see if, in fact, the market is adjusting. And if it's not, question why. And if it is, you know, look into it. And that's what we're trying to do within the Department of Health in, frankly, all our programs, is to monitor the performance of how we are doing on the desired outcomes that we're looking for. In this case, we'd be articulating that we would hope health care costs would be flattening or potentially going down. And so you set up the appropriate indicators to test that. And we know where they are before we expand. What will they be after we expand? So I think we could do that relatively easy. It would fit into the culture of our agency in terms of trying to measure outcomes and see if ultimately the mission or the purpose of this program is achieved. and we could do that for this, and I think it's an excellent idea.
Okay, thank you.
Interrupt a moment. We've got we have not gone through the budget yet. At 2 o'clock, we have to we've got management council for, and there's training for the folks that stay here on iPads, on a variety of things, long-term remedies, reading the budgets. So, and this is, frankly, this is the hardest agency the new members are going to have to deal with. It's the biggest agency. It's the hardest agency. There's no point in rushing this. So, co-chairmans Harshman and Bebout, my recommendation is that we were scheduled to see ANI today, and that's an agency that you might want to have some of the old members with. Tomorrow morning, we've got the auditor, the treasurer, and state lands. My recollection is those are all three easy agencies, and you can hear them. You don't need us to be there, and you could do that during the session. They might be 15 minutes. So my recommendation, with your concurrence, is we have ANI come in tomorrow morning at 8, and that we tell the auditor, treasurer, and Office of State Lands that they're off the hook tomorrow, and we'll bring them back during the session. What do you think about that recommendation? All right. Don, what do you think about that recommendation?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that works. Did you want to still have, I think you could do Workforce Services and ANI. Workforce Services is very straightforward. No.
Is it straightforward? Retirement will take time. You think that work, what I didn't know was, well, are there any, is that a blue or a white?
Or a green.
It's a blue, it's a white?
It is white.
So nothing, well, what we could do is this. Why don't you tell Auditor, Treasurer, Office of State Lands, and Workforce Services to be on call for tomorrow. We'll tell them by noon how fast we're going. We'll put ANI up front, and then we'll start with ANI, and then we'll move directly to the retirement system. So retirement needs to be here, prepared to be here early. With the other four entities, tell them if they will just be available with an hour's notice, we'll tell them whether they're going tomorrow or not. If we can get them off the list, great. But they will go at the end of the day. We'll give them an hour's notice, and if we don't call them tomorrow, then it'll be January. So we'll keep the flexibility, and it may be that if we're ripping along, we can bring them in and just knock them off pretty quickly. How does that sound? So we'll try to knock them off the list if we can't. But the ones that are most important, ANI is going to be important, and retirement, those are the two big ones that we need to get. The other ones will be optional. So we'll go with the important ones first. ANI is off for this afternoon. Have them here in the morning. Retirement goes next. The other four will be on notice. We'll try to get them done. If we can't, they go to January. That make sense?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So with that in mind, we've got we're on pace then to get through your budget by 2. So we've got an hour to go through the budget from 1 to 2. But these are important conversations. It's probably the biggest decision we're going to make this session, whether to go in or opt out of Medicaid. And I would like to talk a little bit about health care exchanges. All right, back to question. Who had the next question with respect to? Harsh.
You know, the question goes really to the whole this mental health piece, and a lot of it's been answered in the discussions, but just looking at your report on page 16, obviously the offsets, the mental health, substance abuse, and that budget is currently over $50 million a year now. Is it? I think it's like $53 million a year. And
I think it's over 60.
Is that in general funds? So it's over 50 in general funds for sure. And these offsets that I look at on page 16, so you're we're going to see reductions in these costs by offsets of, I mean, 10% the first year and then moving up to nearly 40% in some of these years. And I guess, you know, that's real attractive to see that because we obviously built this program when we had $8 natural gas, you know, and we're kind of wondering how we're going to care for it moving forward. But then I guess the apprehension I have is this 90% notion. And is it going to go on? I mean, we see AML funds disappear. We see our federal mineral royalties cut by 2%. And I guess as I go down this road, I guess there's no guarantee the 50-50 would stay if we didn't expand. I guess, I don't know if there's a question in there. I guess my point is if we get in, we can get out. Is there a, you talked about this with Senator Perkins' questions of analysis over time, but is there a way maybe to, I guess we could, Senator Nicholas said that we made a budget amendment, if we decided to opt in, we could make it conditional on the study of indicators. You could make it conditional to get out on if the 90% changes. Any comments on that? Or,
Madam Chairman, Representative Harshman, the question has been raised with me more than once by people other saying, "You, Director, you can't guarantee the 90%. And I've said, you're absolutely right. I cannot guarantee the 90%. But at the same time, I cannot guarantee the 50%. I can't guarantee any percent of federal match rate. All I can do is present the data based on the law as it is today. And that's what the law is today. The response I've said or suggested is the federal government put into place is a couple times a automatic trigger that at a certain point action takes place unless U.S. Congress deliberately takes action to stop it from happening. And thinking about that, I think the state legislature in Wyoming could do the same thing with this expansion group by putting in an automatic trigger that if, for whatever reason, the federal government does not live up to their 90% guarantee for match, then there's a trigger in place that the expansion, the optional portion of that program ends. And the only way then to overturn that would be for the legislature to go in and formally turn that over or make it not applicable. I would think it would be harder to do that than to go in and shut down a program. You know, you need the votes to shut it down as opposed to you need the votes not to allow it to shut down.
Yeah.
It's a difference there. And from what I've seen it play out, it's tougher to stop it than it is to actually do it. And so that would be the only protection that I can think of that potentially could address that issue that comes to mind. The other side of it, as I mentioned earlier in the presentation, is even if you do shut it down, those people who are on the program, their lives, their health, have been better off by coverage for whatever time period it is. The other thing to keep in mind is since this is, frankly, the adult population, and which I kind of deem as the working poor, is chances are these people are not long-term residents or on the Medicaid program. And I'm thinking of a situation with my own daughter. She came out of graduate school. She was working part-time for jobs. She had no coverage, and she was betting on the come that she wouldn't get sick. She ended up getting sick, and she ended up hospitalized. But she was 26, so she couldn't be on my insurance policy anymore. And so she could have been on this program. But frankly, she ultimately got a job, and she has health insurance now. So if she would have been on, she would have been on for a short period of time. So it's that younger age, as well as I think people in service industries and others that that are working one, two, or three jobs, but again, they are not earning enough to get above the poverty level, and their part-time employees generally don't get health insurance. So essentially, they are working and betting on the come that they can't, they're not going to get sick. And so I would guess that a number of these people ultimately won't be long-term stays, as opposed to an elderly or a disabled, which those tend to be on long-term.
So the savings, though, to mental health substance abuse, those numbers on page 16, those could be savings in right to that $50, $60 million general fund appropriation.
Madam Chairman, Representative Harshman, what our thinking is we divert those away from those programs and put it into the Medicaid expansion. Then those mental health providers can go ahead and bill for service for just like every other provider does, healthcare provider does in the state today. They are kind of sitting out there getting block grants, much like some other organizations we fund. They get block grants. It's not depending on insurance coverage. They just get it. And so we would say you can go transfer your business model over to the same as all the other healthcare providers and bill for services. And you won't be losing, you will be losing the block grant, but you'll be more than making it up through billing for services. And because there'll be more people with insurance coverage, both either Medicaid or private insurance. And so I see no reason why the state of Wyoming should continue to provide 100% block grants to these providers and then allow them to continue or allow them to bill for services. It's basically getting paid double for those services. And so it's just simply repurposing the funds. But again, as I mentioned earlier this morning, is we don't shut them off overnight. We give them a few years to transition their business model over to a fee-for-service as opposed to a block grant model.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, thank you. Just, you know, we've been hearing a lot of requests for different kinds of data, presentations on, showing us where there is cost savings within a department. I know that, and I was appreciative of Director Forslund indicating that this is what he sees and what is in his control. There's been some really good points. You know, there is history out there. We have a state that's implemented this type of program with these Medicaid expansions, and we should be able to get some information. My concern is that, you know, that there's going to be fiscal consequences of not doing this and implementing this, as well as quality of life consequences. And I'm not sure if Director Forslund or anyone here can put a dollar amount to the quality of life. I'm sure that we know that, and I totally agree with the director saying that, you know, having a few years of insurance is better than none at all. And so when you talk about quality of life issues, I'm not sure, you know, these are kind of like people issues that we need to look at there. I certainly will support, and, you know, I'm not sure, you know, how much data we're going to need. I mean, we need so much data to make a decision and base our decision on whether we go forward with this. And I'm sure in each one of us that level could possibly be a little bit different. And, you know, and we can certainly muddy the waters with numbers and data that, you know, aren't really relevant to what we're trying to do here, you know, and then taking the option of just saying, well, we're going to, you know, just, well, we're going to sit back and wait a year and see what everybody else does with it. And, you know, I certainly hope that that's not the way this body would end up going. I think we're better leaders than that. And I think that's what we got elected for, was to do that. So I don't know if I really got a question in all of this, Mr. Chairman,
but I'm just concerned. Hold on. We get to debate this, and everybody gets the opportunity to debate this at the time that you get the markup. We're here with almost 20 people that are pretty smart to provide us information. So this is a time to ask questions of these people. We'll do our debating later. With respect to the information, there are members that won't need the information. I submit to you this is a question that should be difficult for every member, because notwithstanding you may feel that a hand of aid, once extended, can never be withdrawn, and therefore you don't want to extend it. This gentleman who's done a lot of research is saying, look, you can't make the decision simply by saying you don't want to expand it. You have to look at the economics of it. So the call to the economics may not go to your heart. It's going to those people that are trying to do an analytical analysis. So let's make sure that we're using their time wisely. So if you've got a question to them, let's use this time to ask them a question, get information.
Yeah, sorry. The last bullet under the department's budget reduction, reimbursements as much as practical to out-of-state providers should be reduced. Can you give me a couple of examples of what our higher costs to out-of-state providers are?
Madam Chairman, let me get the language.
In the governor's message to the legislature, in his budget, under the Department of Health, he had some bullets there about budget reductions. And that last bullet talks about reducing reimbursements to out-of-state providers. And what my question is, give me a couple examples of the higher expenses that we pay to out-of-state providers.
As an example, is Children's Hospital. And the decision has been made in the past that the Department of Health Medicaid program would reimburse at 90% billed charges. And what that decision ultimately made was, I mean, whatever they bill us, we are obligated to pay 90% of that cost. If you compare our rates to other rates in the region for the exact same services, we are significantly higher in terms of what the state of Wyoming is paying for those services than the other states. So what the suggestion is that we bring our payments more in line with other states in the region. And so that would be as an example of how we would adjust reimbursements.
Then, given the magnitude of the request, if you could assign one of your folks that most likely to know what materials have already been presented that are available that don't have to be recreated, and if that's, is it Jamie? Is that
Jesse?
Jesse, and then maybe together with one of our staff person, Don, if you've got time, it might be Don or Don. Maybe there's maybe it's with Jerry Laska or somebody, one of the analysts. Let's figure out what materials are already been collected by labor, and maybe collect them and put them together on our drive to be pushed down. So we create a healthcare information drive. Then we'll talk, and we might even want, if members then want to have that put on a thumb drive so they can take it home on Christmas, but let's first find out what's available. Let's do the analysis of what's already been created before we send you off. And then at that time, if you and your staff would look at what is on the list of documents, and most likely somebody in your organization has already read them or is aware of them, because if they've been produced, they probably were produced by labor. You might make a recommended reading schedule to say, look, these are the ones that are most important. Once you've looked at what's already available and what gets on our that's on this existing data file, then reanalyze the request made of you today to see how you can supplement that without being repetitive and get the questions asked. Does that make sense?
Senator Nicholas, it does. We generated 5-6 reports over the course of the last 9 months, 8 months for joint labor as well as ZIS committee. And so there's a lot of information available for you related to not only the Medicaid program and potential reform or changes to the Medicaid program, the existing program, nothing to do with the expansion, as well as suggestions on how we can significantly make changes in our budget. So that's available, and we would be happy to make them, but recognizing that you're not probably going to wade through all those hundreds of pages, we can try to point out some areas that would be useful for you to take a look at in regards to some of the issues you're dealing with.
That'd be perfect. So we get the reading list, we put it on our website, which pushes down to our iPads, and then if from that list you can give us a recommended areas to look at. And then what you might do is say, give us a confirmation that these are the topics that you're going to look at based upon the request of the members, and try to limit, if you'll help us wade through that stuff and then give us sort of a direction of what you think needs to be supplemented, that'd be great. And then the co-chairs going into January, then we'll have to decide whether to do a callback with you to answer some of the questions. Does that make sense to everybody? If not, look at, if that's great, then we'll be back at 1 o'clock, and we'll go into a short, I'd like to still get a short explanation of the status of the healthcare exchange, and you may just sort of say, this is what the Labor Committee's done, give us there, and then we'll go through your budget with the idea that we'll get done by 2.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, I hope we can have a brief discussion on an alternate budget proposal for this committee to at least think about.
Okay, we'll do that. We will do that. So we'll be prepared. The other thing we could do is come back about 15 minutes earlier, but you guys, if you want to get lunch, you're going to have to go offsite unless you brought your paper bags with you. So
we've
got that. But
we'll have no problems being back at 12:45 if that's...
How does everybody feel about a 45-minute lunch? Okay, we'll be back at 12:45 then.
You did well, Bob.